Previously on Popping Collars.
So how did the struggle of life in the wilderness kind of sit with you guys?
Well, first off, I just want to say, let's applaud the payoff of all my Ken Burns watching, because the West, and we're like in the Dakotas, and I'm like freaking out at this movie. I'm like, this is everything that I've been watching, which the West is full of a great deal of death and misery. And it's like, when you watch things of particular times, you're like, how did any of my relatives survive?
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I'm your host. My name is Greg Knight, and I am in Palm Beach, Florida. With me are my co-hosts, Betsy Gonzalez from Alexandria, Virginia.
Hi, Greg.
And Kyle Goodman from Statesville, North Carolina. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Greg. How are you tonight?
Excellent. And special guest from Berkeley, California, it's Trip Hudgens. Welcome to the show, Trip.
Thank you very much. I'm feeling very special.
This is episode 32 of the 1,433rd ranked podcast in the iTunes spirituality category. And our topic today is social media grieving. So I'm going to start with you, Trip.
Okay.
You recently wrote a piece in Sojourners entitled All My Favorite Theologians Are Dying, which was about celebrity deaths over the past month, mm-hmm. specifically referencing David Bowie and Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what is it about the passing of famous people that has such an impact on us? What kind of led you to write that piece?
Well, the key, actually, just right there in the name of the piece, is the word theologian. These people are more than, you know, pop icon, or we use icons in any number of ways, right? You know, this welcome to the postmodern era. I mean, I really wasn't exaggerating when I think of Bowie as a theologian. He might not have always been the best moral example, but the songs. Everyone starts quoting Major Tom, and it's every line from a song. It becomes this incredibly meaningful way to describe the nature of life and our place in it. The cosmos gets shifted. You know, planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do. I mean, this becomes an incredibly powerful theological statement, or, you know, it's not just speaking of a universal truth. I mean, he's really after something. And in various interviews, Bowie said, you know, he wasn't sure he believed in God, but he knew that he was pushing after something. Bowie was pushing, and absolutely was one of my sort of go-to theologians in that sense. Yeah. And I lost him. I still have I have John Calvin's books on my shelves too. I still have his music. It's still there. But when they actually die, when they actually leave us, and you know you're not going to get anything else, there's this gaping hole. It's not the same as having the recording on my phone. And that's what it was for me. And Alan Rickman was the same way. I can go on and on about this. My wife actually got to meet Alan Rickman. She was in Oxford for a theater workshop one summer. I was there most of the summer. And he came in one day and led a masterclass. And so there's this great picture. My wife is 4'11" and Rickman was like 6'3", 6'4". And so there's this great picture of the two of them. And he signed a copy of Hamlet for me and, you know, made sure that he was just that kind of person. And you go back through and you read these things about what he was really like, how he understood the nature of theater in society, the universal truths it was intended to create beyond simple entertainment. And you realize you're losing a leading voice in what it actually is to be human. It's not just mm-hmm. about digging the music or thinking that Harry Potter is a cool tale, though it is. It's getting into these stories.
And yet I think you nailed something really important when you said, I lost.
Yeah.
This, you know, we lost these people. There's something personal
yeah.
about the connection that you share with an artist, whether it be a musician, whether it be a film actor, mm-hmm. stage actor, mm-hmm. or something like that. It's like if somebody affects your emotion, all of a sudden you've kind of let them into yourself. And so that's the piece that kind of gets lost a little bit,
right,
maybe.
Right. These people now have, some of these people who are living have social media profiles. And they share their lives. Toni Morrison is one who shares her life and wrote an article recently. I was interviewed recently about pain and suffering. She has horrible arthritis and is wheelchair bound, but still writes this amazing stuff about lately about regret. And, you know, that stuff shows up in papers. It shows up in a paper on human suffering and lamentations. And what do you do with that? Well, it's because these people actually follow them on social media. I mean, think about that way that social media helps us feel like whether we have an actual relationship or not, helps us feel like we have a relationship. It sort of magnifies that experience of the icon of celebrity, where they're sort of on the same plane with us, even if they're not.
You know, you mentioned lamentations and this idea of kind of public grieving. I think that that's necessary somehow, but I think social media is doing that in kind of a different way.
Well, I mean, now that we have, you know, digital bouquet laying that is just kind of happening, right? And it happens whether it's somebody who's famous or somebody who isn't. You know, we're now, you can designate on your Facebook status who your legacy contact is for your page, so that then everything gets turned over to them. They can choose to keep the page alive as a memorial, or they can choose to have, you know, download an entire like PDF of your Facebook life for them to keep, or, you know, as your legacy contact. And it's just, I was reading over the page today the first time. It never actually really says that you die. Just kind of says, you know, legacy contact is someone you choose to look after your account if it's memorialized. Which I just find really fascinating, just even the language and talking about it. But I think that public grieving process is, it's in the same way that we can like something and it's just kind of something quick we can do. But then at the same time, just incredibly poignant tributes to people who've been foundational to people. And I think as particularly Gen X, who remembers life before this digitally and now is in it really intensely. Thank you. Is really in it very intensely. Mm-hmm. And our heroes start to die.
Yeah.
As we're all, you know, hovering around above and below the age of 40, the fragility of life and all of that is just, and the mortality things and the fact that your kids are at that age when they are asking about death. It's just, it's all feeding this, you know, I hear so much musing about mortality and pop music and all this kind of stuff nowadays.
Yeah. And I do think it's really important. This piece about having the ability to give expression to what you're feeling. You know, in my context, I've done my fair share of funerals in the 8 years that I've been Statesville. I've done, I think, 65 funerals, which I think is a lot. There's something, you know, of course, there's this great sadness when we lose someone, but I find a lot of joy, and my word is catharsis, at having the opportunity to stand up in the pulpit and say something about that life and let it be, you know, a witness, you know, imperfect though it is, to Christ. That's a really important thing for me. And oddly enough, about the time I sort of feel like my ministry is kind of in a rut, I seem to have a funeral. And again, I wouldn't want to lose anyone, but, you know, all of a sudden, just that opportunity to, you know, lift up someone's life and what it meant to me and what it meant to the community, oddly enough, is just this moment that, again, it gives expression to what I'm feeling and is creative and even generative. And I think there's something to that, talking about social media. If I get to do that, you know, and really, I think most of my grief work personally, when I lose someone in my church that I'm close to, most of my grief work is really done in writing that message and giving it from the pulpit. And I think that social media in some ways gives everyone their pulpit, you know, to stand up and say what this person, be it a celebrity or someone close to them that's not a celebrity, it gives them that pulpit to stand up and say, you know, you give expression, offer their words in some sense as a eulogy to that person.
Yeah, we talk about that, especially in classrooms with, you know, in teaching kids. There's a social need that your students need to somehow meet. And so if you're doing really engaging teaching, then that social need is being met in your teaching. And so I think we've all been involved in funerals where it feels like everybody wants to talk. Everybody wants to get up and say something. And it's always a really hard time to be able to say, well, I need to see what you're going to say before you get up there and talk. I need to, you know, this is not a wake, it's a funeral. But right. There's something that is allowing, like what Kyle's saying, that expression to happen. I need it to happen somewhere. And if I'm not going to talk at the funeral, or if I'm worried that what I might say might be judged, or I'm not enough, I can put it in this other forum. And I feel like I've that discharge of grief that somehow needed to be public is public.
And of course, where it connects into our conversation about celebrities is just that, you know, these are people that I think we all, in some sense, feel like we know, or at least we know their work, and we have established some connection to them.
That's got to be especially true of musicians, just because of how intimate the work is, because it becomes like a soundtrack for your life, right? I mean, David Bowie was the soundtrack of so many people's lives, and that's the loss piece. And I think the dark side of it, though, right, is this kind of realization, you know, we had talked about it before, but this idea that you recognize your own mortality, but, you know, the other side of that is people saying, well, like, my childhood died, or my teenage years died, or something. It's like, no, you still have those years. That's still there. Those memories, that music, that's still a part of who you are. It's just that the musician is gone. And I don't know that people really process that well on social media, it seems like.
I'm 46 years old. My entire life, I've heard the music of David Bowie. It's not that he's the music of my childhood, or he was the music of my teen years, or whatever. He's been releasing music for as long as I've been alive. There are many people like that. Like, I do not remember life without David Bowie. The earliest memory I have of watching a video on MTV was Little China Girl, right? And who is this David Bowie guy? I had no idea it's the same person as Ziggy Stardust, right? I had no clue, because he's this chameleon, right? So the impact, it's not just momentary for me, right? When I talk about these people being theologians, it's not that one day I heard, you know, the words Ground Control to Major Tom, and it was evocative in all these different ways and leads me to this understanding of the Trinity because blah. No, the first time it's this bizarre song about, you know, this guy who has a space odyssey. And it's a sad song. And it's trippy. That's the first time I hear it. Now, you know, fast forward however many decades, and I've added all this meaning to it. It's not simply the music of my childhood. It's the music of the last 40 years, right? That song shows up again and again and again for four decades. I hear it more than I hear the music that I hear in church, right? I mean, that's the reason why I say our theologians are dying is, you know, everyone knows Amazing Grace, but that's because it's sung more than just on Sunday mornings once or twice a year. But the number of people who can sit down and recite the words to this, you know, Space Odyssey by David Bowie just explodes. Like, I'd love to have the statistics, the data on that. How many people could recite a song by David Bowie but not give you every verse from a hymn in the hymnal? Because we hear it so much. We simply make more meaning with it.
Oh, sure. Right. It's like the lectionary of our lives.
Right.
I mean, that's what, right, you know, as a music fan, and I would say this, you could do this with film and those sorts of things, that there's films that you can watch or albums that you can listen to when you're in your teens, to then listen to them in your 20s, to then listen to them in your 30s, and then to have a kid and listen to them, and then to lose a parent and listen to them, and then to, and that it changes, it alters. You greet it in a different way. It is scripture.
Right.
And so you come to it differently every time.
Right. And this is why I think it's really interesting when we talk about why we feel it so personally. And it's not that I feel like I knew David Bowie. It's that his stuff was scripture. In the same way that we say we know Jesus, right? We can have an intimate encounter, something that feels so viscerally familiar with the divine. And I think it's analogous to how we experience people through music.
You know, there's something about familiarity. There's something about the age when people die and the circumstances when they die. So Robin Williams was a big one for that. I'm a self-professed wrestling fan on this show, and so many of those guys die young.
Yeah.
that it's like a gut punch every single time. And you know, you think to yourself, man, what did these guys do to their bodies? What did they do to their careers? Like, what were they hiding? Like, what was it that was driving them? What was, you know, what were the things that they were fighting? Because what I knew wasn't who they were necessarily.
Robin Williams was the worst for me in that, thinking about the body of his work and how many his films were life affirming. I mean, some of the ones that weren't so great, I think of like Patch Adams or What Dreams May Come. But even the better ones, you know, Good Morning Vietnam. You know, just this radical push for a life-affirming ethic. And then, you know, to hear, you know, the tragedy that he experienced personally just felt like such a disconnect to me initially. You know, this is the last guy I expect to take his own life. He's the guy in his work that's, you know, that's affirmed the goodness of life and every part of it. How can we find him, you know, lost in that very thing? And yet, I think you said it, Greg, that, you know, who experienced these, you know, celebrities to be is not necessarily the people that they are. And ultimately, I think we find in their deaths that they're really more like us than the pedestal that we've put them on.
But I'd love to hear what you guys think, because this is something I've been puzzling through, right? How many people who were touring in the late 60s and early 70s are going to live into their 80s? We'll see some folks do it, but they lived a hard, hard life for a long, long time. And in that, they proclaimed an ideal about an eternal youth movement. You know, this music from the 60s and 70s, especially, this is youth movement music, and it hits us throughout our lives. We employ it differently, but still, there are the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger saying, you know, I'm dead at 40, and they're still touring. But what is that? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, and I think, too, it's the beginning of – they were the beginning of the youth market. Like, yeah. We're marketing directly to young people. When I moved out of the 18 to 35 or whatever that prize demo was – that was a really hard birthday for me. That was really hard. Like, I was like, I don't know.
Marketers don't care what you think.
Nobody cares what I think. Turn her out to pasture. You know, whatever.
Coke over Pepsi.
Put my name in for this online drawing of something? My birthday, you know, I'm out, right? You know, David Bowie would be one of those people that has aged along with his music. U2 is another example. Age along with their music. Change and grow and be different and not be stuck in the past.
The question that I had, you know, Kyle, you've already touched on it already, this idea that, you know, you are in the funeral business, right? You're in the storytelling. And we touched on this a little bit when Robin Williams died. This idea of, like, being pastor to Facebook. That's something that I feel like our world kind of falls into the trap of sometimes. Like, I've got the definitive statement. I've got the quintessential story that's going to draw everybody in and heal everyone of this terrible grief that's been afflicted. I feel like a lot of times, like, we fall into this trap of being the pastoral hero in our various spaces. I mean, part of it's ego, but what else is kind of driving that boat that we want to kind of hug the world and help everybody get over it?
Well, you know, it's really difficult on social media to have a practice of the ministry of presence. You know, when what's best in the situation in a room with folks who are grieving is really not to say much of anything, that opportunity doesn't really exist on Facebook. You're either saying something or you're saying nothing, and that means you're just not there. And so I think there's a real temptation to fall back into the trap of, you know, trying to solve everything and bring healing with a lot of words. And I know I have just personally been very guilty of typing out the 10 paragraph homily / essay / dissertation in a Facebook comment, thinking that that's just going to solve everyone's, you know, grief or solve everyone's issue. And yet things just continue to roll on like it didn't matter what I said. It's really disappointing.
Did you not read my post?
Did you not read the post? I fixed this.
I've solved the Glenn
Here,
Frey
exactly.
Problem.
Here, let me link to that.
Well, and it's also, I mean, that yeah, and even in the invitation that many of us receive in the line of work that we're in, to be present in the process, not just post-death, but in the process of dying, the person dying. Mm-hmm. I've had an experience this year with a colleague who I love very much, and at a previous school, being sick, and you're monitoring treatments and what's going on, and things are happening, and then you notice the nature of things start to change, and we're now in hospice, and we're having good days and bad days, and the page, you know, is today's a good day to visit, today's not a good day to visit, and just the things people leave, and the pictures and the jokes, and you can suddenly start to see this person's life and the roles that different people fulfill kind of starting to weave together on their Facebook page. Oh, well, this is the person who always tells the jokes and posts the inappropriate pictures, you know, and this person is this person is that person. And to then watch all the way through her death and then into memorializing her loss. It was actually really, it was really beautiful. And it was something that, I think in some of the more trivialness of social media, it was something that was really beautiful. And I'm reminded how often the general public is not privy to death in the way that we can be privy to death, and that social media has brought it into our lives again in a more present way. And it's all jumbled up with, you know, the latest Kardashian thing in your feed and what your favorite sports team is doing, but it's there. And it's to watch it happen to somebody digitally, you know. And we talked before we started broadcasting about Joey Feek, country singer who's dying and is it in currently home care, hospice type care, and just posts on their blog on people.com and pictures and updates and just kind of in the process of dying. And social media is allowing that to happen again. And kind of what is the world doing with that information?
One of the more personal stories that I've had running through my head since y'all invited me to participate in this was when my stepmother's sister died. My aunt Anne passed away a few years ago. And I was here in California, and this my family's back east in Virginia. And I was on the phone. We were constantly texting pictures back and forth and just checking in. And like literally the day before she died, we were texting. And when she passed away, the pastor of her church did this astonishing simple thing. Recognizing that Anne had family all over the country, she took a picture of this small memorial table. It's a Baptist church in Richmond, Ginter Park Baptist Church. There's this table underneath this beautiful stained glass window, and she lit a candle under it for Anne. And then she took a picture of the candle and posted it on the church's Facebook page. And she said, if you cannot get here today, whether it's because you're stuck in the office here in Richmond or you live 3,000 miles away, let me know and I will light a candle for you. And I will keep posting new pictures. And they did. Right. So I have saved, you know, one of the last images you know, with all of these candles as a memorial to my aunt on the day she died. Right.
Wow.
Right. It was just really powerful to, you know, we've been talking about the challenges, the differences, the distinctions between virtual reality and the rest of our lives. And it's a helpful rhetoric. But at the same time, we're not separate people online and offline. We may present differently, but we're not separate people. And our deaths aren't separate. Right. It's the same death. It just presents differently online than it does offline.
Mm-hmm.
And so Anne's death was presented in one way online. And then when I flew east for the funeral and gave the eulogy, it presented differently at her service. But it was the same death. And I think we are giving ourselves opportunities through social media to actually participate in a new way. It's surprising us all. What I'm hearing a lot is how surprising it is that we can actually honor one another in this way, and that it does touch us to watch candles appear on a table or watch David Bowie's last music video entitled Lazarus, right? It touches us very, very deeply.
Last segment real quick, which I'm retitling the 5-minute coffee hour, where we just kind of kick around a pop culture topic that we kind of bring up, and we pretend like we've got a big old bagel in one hand and a cup of Maxwell House in the other and just kind of chat about it. But first, before we get to that, I was just wondering, Tripp, do you have any a website, a blog, Twitter feed, church website, anything you want to plug?
I'm all over the place. AngloBaptist.org still exists. I am there. So check me out. And that's the name across the intertubes. So it's AngloBaptist on Twitter. You can find me AngloBaptist on Facebook.
Very good. All right. So, 5-minute coffee hour. Who has, some piece of pop culture that they're just dying to chat about at their next sort of, coffee hour time? I've got one.
Oh, good.
Well, why don't you share it?
Okay. So I just started teaching a class, called God in Film, you know, just kind of a regular kind of title, but we've been looking at Hollywood biblical epics and how they affect how we hear scripture.
Mm-hmm.
This may sound familiar because this was one of our shows.
Yes.
One of our episodes.
This might sound
this may sound familiar to some of you. What a lot of you didn't know is that I had never actually seen a biblical epic before I started teaching this class. That podcast.
You never saw the Ten Commandments.
That's right.
With Charles and
right.
Heston? How was that?
No, I've never seen the Ten Commandments, never seen King of Kings, never seen Greatest Story Ever Told, never seen any of it.
I've never seen King. I haven't seen King.
So I started teaching this class having seen none of this stuff. I love it. I love it all. It's wonderful. I watched the Ten Commandments. It's got a love triangle between Moses and Ramses and Nefertiti that's amazing. At one point, Nefertiti says, I know that it's not a mountain, only a mountain that moves you, Moses. Like, it's total, like, camp and sex and amazing.
Yeah.
But then I got to watch Godspell. I loved it. Like, I love all of these things. I guess I thought of myself as somebody that didn't like Bible movies because I associated them with, like, evangelical Christians or whatever. Like, this is what I watch at Easter, you know, that kind of thing. But, like, I'm totally in that camp now. I'm a biblical epic, like, convert.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yes.
Well, then don't go watch the Russell Crowe Noah movie. That'll end
it. Do it, do it, do it,
do it. No. No, that will genre for Greg. That's it. The Noah movie, he's out.
Yeah, this is true. Sure.
Well, what was the sword and sandals-y Moses retelling that just came out with Christian Bale?
Oh, the King of Gods and Kings.
Gods and Kings. Lots right, more yeah. sword play with Moses than I was ever aware of. My kids in class are always like, are you going to go watch that movie? And I'm like, no, because then I have to undo all the poor scripture that's happening and then tell you what's actually happening.
Did you ever think the worst part of Ten Commandments was that it didn't have enough gladiator in it?
Right. I think that was the pitch on that one.
No, but it's like, but this is all cinematic midrash, right? Isn't that what they, when they were talking about the Noah movie, when they were interviewing the filmmaker, you're like, this is, Kathleen Falsani had this great interview with, oh my gosh, the filmmaker for Noah.
It wasn't Ridley Scott, was it?
No. It was the guy that did Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah,
and
Noah. No.
Abrams. No.
Drat. Aaron starts with an A.
Aronofsky. Aronofsky.
Aronofsky.
We're going to edit until it sounds like we immediately came up with
Aronofsky. Edit that out. Kathleen Falsani's interview with Aronofsky is great because he basically says, look, he went to Midrash on the story and then added more as a cinematographer because the medium allows him to do Midrash differently, right? So you have the Nephilim and you have all sorts of crazy stuff going on. And it's fantastic in that sense because it is fantasy. What makes the Cecil B. DeMille movie so wonderful is that they insist on treating it like it's history. Right. And history on a grand scale, right? This is the empire doing the thing. It's, you know, George Lucas watched Cecil B. DeMille movies before he ever filmed one inch of film for Star Wars, right? It's all Cecil B. DeMille does space opera. And it's that same sort of thing. I love that about them. If you ever get a chance to check out the book, Ben-Hur, do so. It's written by a retired army general who had his own conversion experience, and Ben-Hur is his sort of his archetypical masculine believer. What does a masculine Christianity look like? Well, it's Charles and Heston in a chariot. Not just putting that out there, but it's a fantastic book. You will need something strong to drink when you read it, but it's fantastic.
That's great.
Nice. All right. So that's it. Biblical ethics. I recommend it.
So that's it. All right.
Okay. So, let me plug the show real fast. You can find Popping Collars on the web at poppingcollarspodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/poppingcollars, where you can like us. Please feel free to subscribe to us also on iTunes so that we can move up in the rankings and finally crack that top 1,000.
Come on. I mean, what have we got to do?
Oh, and we're also featured on EpiscopalCafe.com. We love EpiscopalCafe.com. We know you will, too. Check them out for all your Episcopal news and beyond. And so with that, that is Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Tripp. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Kyle, for being on the show. We'll see you next time.
Keep those collars popped.